From the campus of the University of Hawaii, this is the Center for Southeast Asian Studies Lecture Series Podcast. Podcasts, video streaming, MP3 downloads, and more are available at hawaii.edu/CSEAS and at iTunes.
Yeah, first of all, I would like to thank Barbara for being here and for sponsoring, together with Political Science, this talk. I am still a little bit jet-lagged because I arrived from Cambodia after 22 hours flight to New York City, and then the next day I came to Cambodia. So I'm not sure whether I'm jet-lagged from Cambodia or from New York. So if I'm a little bit incoherent, please forgive me. Today, I would like to concentrate. I have two talks today, but this lunchtime talk, I would like to concentrate on the trials, because what I saw in Cambodia last week was, at the least, bizarre. You know, it's April is always a busy month in Cambodia. And I already said I just returned. Monday, 14th April, is a celebration of Khmer New Year. And this is celebrated in Thailand, Myanmar, and Laos, and maybe, I don't know, Vietnam. No, Vietnam has Tet. So this is the Songkran in Thailand. It's a huge celebration in Cambodia. This week is completely shut down for the whole week. But today is also the anniversary of the beginning of the genocidal Khmer Rouge regime. So we have selected a great day, Barbara. You know, you have selected a great day for me to... May I ask the audience to have 1 minute of silence to commemorate this, the death of 2 million Cambodians. Thank you. Yes, it's now 30 years since this event. But of course, in Cambodia, people still are suffering the trauma of this unspeakable crimes of the Khmer Rouge. So last week I saw this man, you know, sitting there on the dock surrounded by highly paid UN security guards and judges. It cost a fortune, you know. It is bizarre because this is the man who 30 years ago tortured and killed 16,000 people without any process. In fact, one of the survivors, there are only 10 survivors from this 16,000 people that he tortured and killed. One of the survivors was standing there and accusing, you know, why this man gets a defendant, you know? I think this man is a defendant, a very highly paid defendant, you know, all UN paid, you know. And he says, when I was sentenced by him, I have nothing, you know. And the other one, Chum Mei, is another, says that he was imprisoned by this Duke, by this Duich, we pronounce it, and he was accused of sabotaging the textile industry because all the needles, he says, were broken. Well, it's the needles made in China. In those days, China was not as accomplished as today. So he was accused of sabotaging by breaking those needles. And then he was tortured and tortured until he confessed, you know, who are your collaborators? You are CIA. And who are your collaborators? So he was just senseless. So he started blurting out names of friends, of family. And then they all came and got tortured also. So this man was sitting there, as you can see. Well, he is now a born-again Christian, he says, you see. And he is sitting there talking about his crimes. But there is one thing, at least he confessed, you know. He says, I'm sorry what I did. And he was in tears. Well, not in tears. Actually, those two defendants, Chum Mei and the other were in tears. But then he talks as a matter of factly, you know, about what he did, because the prosecutor and the witnesses talk in details about the torture, you see. And then he says, oh, no, no, we didn't do this nail, you know, but that's too inefficient. You know, we prefer to do this, and we prefer beatings and whippings. Now, his prisoners were shackled, you know, in a room like this, maybe 40, shackled the whole night, you know. So when they have to go to the bathroom, they have to call, but if the guard doesn't relieve them, then that's it. So it is a bizarre moment. That's why I asked you for one moment silence, because today, of course, the bizarre thing is that the Cambodian people have a pyramid like this. If, you know, so that means there are a lot of young people who have were not even born yet. So in front of this, now Cambodia is prosperous. In the last 10 years, the rate of growth is, you know, I'm an economist, 10%, which is very high. Well, except for the last year, because they, of course, their main exports is textiles to the U.S., and people here are buying less made in Cambodia, and but they don't have suffering from the subprime mortgage or any of those MBS, you know, mortgage-based securities or so on. But it is still bizarre, you see, because this man is there, you know, torturing people at will, and now he is sitting there according to international standards. That's what the UN says, you know. Well, this is a good thing, you know. Here in this country, you are a serial killer, and you still have to be proven that you are guilty. That's what justice is about. But I will tell you in a little bit that all kinds of complications because of these international standards were there. Well, here are just some bizarre pictures. Now, these pictures were taken by were actually paintings by Van Net. He is one of the seven, or did I say eight? Yeah, seven or eight survivors. He survived because he was asked to paint Pol Pot, who is the leader of the Khmer Rouge. And he painted this, how they tortured the people. And this is another one where she was asked to give the baby, and the baby is just smashed against the tree. So the Deutsch and four other senior Khmer Rouge cadres who have killed these 1.7 million people, allegedly, are on trial. Nuon Chea, Ieng Sary, Ieng Thirit, and Khieu Samphan. The biggest one, Pol Pot, has died, you see. So, and this is the tragedy, you know. It's 30 years after this happened. These people are all ailing people, you know. They might die before they are being tried. Well, they are being tried, but so far the first one is Mr. Deutsch. The others have not been tried yet. Ieng Sary goes to the hospital all the time, you know, costing us, the UN, you know, a fortune. But, you know, again, the survivors say, oh, this man goes to the best hospitals. But this is the irony of the trials, which we will discuss in a little bit. So today I want to concentrate on three questions. How long should I talk?
As long as I think we have room to 1:30, so.
Oh, okay, yeah. And then, but I like a discussion,
yes,
also.
Yes.
Yes. Why was the trial delayed for 30 years? And two is, who should be tried? How many should be tried? This sounds like a very simple question, but I will tell you, this is very complicated. Number three, of course, I like the audience to help me to see whether justice means just trying a bunch of old men, you know, who are about to die anyway. Now, here comes the commercial, as Barbara said. This, if you go to Barnes & Noble, it's $30 plus tax. But here is $25 plus my signature, you see. And, well, I'm not saying just to sell the book, but this book talks about all the things that are recent, you know. So it's my 5 years in Cambodia. That's the, it's, I was there 5 years. I'm Indonesian, but I'm in Cambodia not as Indonesian, but as the United Nations, because we supposedly was to bring peace, you know. I said supposedly or was to bring peace because we didn't, you know, as Alvin says in his review of my book. Now you have two books in one, you see. Part one is during my peacekeeping operation. This is a completely interesting story for people who are interested in peacekeeping. This is 2 years. We brought peace, supposedly. I keep saying that, but I'll tell you in the detail why. And we brought elections, at least. And the second period, UNTAC, the first one, everyone went back, and I was appointed the UN ambassador to Cambodia for the second period. And the second period, there is still a lot of turmoil because, as I say in a minute, the Khmer Rouge was coddled by the UN. And that's why the subtitle of my book is Sihanouk, the Khmer Rouge and the United Nations in Cambodia. They are dancing in shadows, you know. It's like they are in shadows conspiring to bring the downfall of Cambodia. Yes, the UN too. Well, I'm retired, so they cannot fire me. And they cannot take my pension, but our pension is already down with the stock market. Because even Bill Gates lost $22 billion. You know, the poor man will be in the homeless section of Hawaii soon. And the second one is when I was serving to the new government of Cambodia. So this is the whole story is about post-conflict peace building and peacekeeping. And the reason why I bring it up today is that why the trial was delayed for 30 years. And that I start my book by saying Cambodia is a victim of the Cold War. During the Cold War, Cambodia was subjugated to ongoing power struggles of her hegemony in Southeast Asia. As a result, prior to the arrival of UNTAC, of which I was a member, for more than 20 years, Cambodia was plunged into chaos, turmoil, civil war, and deep despair. So it's not just the 5 years of the Khmer Rouge, it is 20 years. And that's why my book is different. Since I'm before scholars here, it's, of course, you want to know how different is this from Shawcross and so on. It's different because I mentioned that I said in here that there were 20 years of turmoil, you know. And even when we are there, the turmoil continues. The Khmer Rouge continues to reign, and that's why we have this delay in the trial. Well, this I already mentioned. Everyone knows about this. And now in January 7, 1979, at last, Cambodia was liberated by none other than the Vietnamese army, plus a rebel army of ex-Khmer Rouge soldiers under, so ex-Khmer Rouge, this Hun Sen, Heng Samrin, and Chia Sim. Now, you have to look carefully at these faces because that's January 7, 1979. But today they are still there, you see. So they are not only very tenacious, but very patient. Because what happened after this liberation, my story now goes to New York. Because my book, I was wearing three lenses for writing my book. One is an observer on the ground, because I was there 5 years, I see with my own eyes. And the second one is, if I'm not in Cambodia, I'm in New York. So I see this incredible manipulations in the United Nations. And the third pair of lenses, as Barbara says, I was writing this book in Cornell. So my book fleets from Cambodia to New York, not to Cornell, but to a political analysis. And I feel that now this, rather than putting the Khmer Rouge leaders on trial, like the German leaders at the end of World War II, the United Nations, spearheaded by the US and China, recognized by a majority vote. So you should not just blame China and the US, although they are a lot to blame because they are members of the five permanent members of the United Nations who control the United Nations. We have 193 members now, with Montenegro and Switzerland members, but also the five members control the UN, and they can do anything they want. Well, not anything, because in the Security Council, one of these five is the Soviet Union. So first they want to condemn Vietnam for invading Cambodia, but the Soviet Union vetoed. So then they went to the General Assembly. That's where people are seated as representing their countries. And in the General Assembly, they say, no, we cannot seat the Hun Sen's People's Republic because they are installed by Vietnam. They are puppets of Vietnam. So instead, we should recognize this Khmer Rouge, who has killed 1.7 million. Now, to me, this is a travesty of justice. So again, here it's not the first time this is mentioned, but I exposed this, you know, the votes in New York. I exposed this in my book, the maneuverings that went on, which makes this possible. Because India, as the head of the non-aligned countries, that's a big bloc in the UN, India proposed that, why don't we leave the seat empty? But no, they said, let's recognize the Khmer Rouge. It's like Hitler, you see. Let them sit there, because we don't like this face of this Hun Sen. He's a puppet of the Vietnamese. And the majority complied with this wish of the US and China, and they became the de facto government of Cambodia. This travesty of justice continued for 11 years. 11 years, they managed every year to, because everyone, you know, says, it's the only ones who voted for the Khmer Rouge, for the People's Republic of Cambodia was Vietnam, China, no, not China. China is on the other side with the US. It's Vietnam, Russia, the Soviet bloc, and India from the non-neutral countries. So there were two governments, you know. One is the Khmer Rouge, who has killed 1.7 million but continue to be recognized because the US doesn't like the face of Vietnam and they don't want another Vietnam in Cambodia. So how do we solve this problem? They then say, oh, brilliant idea from an Australian, Gareth Evans, Prime Minister at that time. Oh, let the UN be the government of Cambodia. Then they can resolve this problem. Oh, yes, yes, very brilliant, you see. And so we, the UN became the government of Cambodia. Or so we thought, you know. No, but I became the governor of a province called Siem Reap. That's where the Angkor Wat is. So I arrived with my UN brigades, you know, Irish police, Bangladeshi soldiers, and the Irish police were all the biggest drinkers and very good drinkers, you know. They never get drunk, I don't know, somehow. Anyway, I arrived at the governor's mansion and I said, you know, good morning, Governor Nuosam. No, I said, good morning, I am the governor of this province. So he says, no, I am the governor of this province. No, I said, no, I am. So anyway, to make a long story short, of course, I blinked. This is chapter 3 of the book. So what is this strange thing, you know, called the UN becoming the government? Because for 11 years, the UN, remember, did not recognize this Hun Sen fellow. for 11 years. So they have like an ostrich, you know. Oh, Hun Sen doesn't exist. So let Benny be the governor of Siem Reap, you know. It's ridiculous because Hun Sen existed, you know. This is a country very poor because in those 11 years, they were a pariah. The donors say, no, not a single penny for that. Hun Sen, they is not the government of Cambodia. So they didn't get any foreign aid. So after the Khmer Rouge 5 years or 3 years plus, they suffered another 11 years without foreign aid. The only aid they got was 100 million from the Soviet Union. So when we arrived in Cambodia, I was part of this. It was the most poor, poverty-stricken country, even though 11 years ago the Khmer Rouge has left. There was nothing like that, like what is there today. Now, finally, in June, yeah, okay. So during that whole period, as I said, what is different in my book from others is that I think the Paris agreements were flawed also. Because the Paris agreements continue to recognize the Khmer Rouge as an equal partner. You know, continuing the farce of the 11 years that they were recognized, the US and China insist the Khmer Rouge should be an equal partner. So there were four equal partners. Khmer Rouge, this Hun Sen, that is, as I mentioned several times, is the real de facto government. Then there is Phun Sin Pek, that is the king's party, King Sihanouk, or French Sihanouk. And the fourth one is a pro-American faction called KPNLF. So during this UNTAC period, the Khmer Rouge continued to attack us because that's why I call this a flaw in the Paris Agreement. And this is new in my book, you see. Others have not, they always say the UN is the savior, you know, hail the UN. But it's a flaw because I told my Bangladeshi soldiers and my Irish police, don't consider the Khmer Rouge your enemy. According to the Paris Agreement, they are good boys. Of course, they were not good boys. It's like releasing a patient from a mental yard and say, oh, he is a good boy, and he starts killing again. Because that's what the Khmer Rouge did, continues to kill and maim, and we were not allowed in their zone. We are supposed to be everywhere because they are an equal partner, but we were not allowed in their zones. So that's where this was a farce. So after UNTAC left, we had this new government, as I said. Did I have a slide of that? Yes, headed by two prime ministers. Now, this is where part two of my book starts. It's the shadow boxing or wayang play, you know. But my Indonesian friends who are experts on wayang are angry if I call it wayang. They say wayang is noble playing, not this Khmer Rouge business. But there are the good guys versus the bad guys, you know. So shadow boxing is a better analogy. The shadow, my part two is shadow boxing between the two and also the king, because this king is a wily fellow and very shrewd and very mercurial, you know, King Sihanouk. He was crowned by the French in 1941. They were hoping that he was like Bao Dai in Vietnam. You see, he's a playboy and they can just forget him. Well, he is a playboy, all right. He married at least six women, you know, including two of his aunts. But he is also a very shrewd politician. And to make a long story short, he brought independence to Cambodia. He demanded, and 53. But 55, he became bored of being a king, you know. I have nothing to do, just ceremony. I don't want to be a king. My father is now king. I'm Prince Sihanouk. So he became prince as head of state. And so this is Sihanouk for you. So when I came there as ambassador, I presented my credentials to this king. And he was so happy because the Khmer Rouge just attacked, you know. Remember, UNTAC, we were not supposed to touch the Khmer Rouge. They are the good guys. And this, the first thing they did when the new government started, they attacked. And this king was sitting in a palace like this, you know, And he was just gesticulating to me because, Excellency Widiono, the Khmerus will take this part of Cambodia. It is a crescent, and we will have two Cambodias. So here comes my Cornell position. In Cornell, I found out why. Well, I was reflecting, you know, in this beautiful garden. Have you been to Kehin Center?
Yes,
I had my office there. I was there, the equivalent of Center for Southeast Asian Studies hosted me. And anyway, I was reflecting there why the king was so happy with the Khmerus. Well, because he wants, as I said, to be a king that rules. And here, these two people, you know, he says this Ranarit, who is an idiot, you know, and this Hun Sen, who is a great communist, but he is a... The king always says, I wish Hun Sen was my son, not the idiot, you know, Ranarit. Am I being taped here? Anyway. They will have fun at the podcast if I'm taped. But so he was very happy that the Khmerus, that's why I put in my book that, you know, actually he was happy because he wants to be, he is angry that these two now are in power, you know, and he doesn't have any power. He sits there, as he said at one point, this is chapter 9, the king reigns but does not rule. And he is sitting there in his palace, you know, with no power. He is very unhappy. But going back to our topic of today, I'm just telling this because the reason, as I said, why the Khmerus trial was delayed. Because during that period, of course, nobody wanted to try the Khmerus. First, Americans and the rest, and the West and the rest, are recognizing them as the government of Cambodia for 11 years. So you cannot try in a tribunal people who are in the government. Secondly, during the UN, as I said, we have to treat the Khmerus with velvet gloves. So again, you cannot treat the Khmerus, try the Khmerus. Now, finally, in June 1997, there was a UN person, you know, called Thomas Hammarberg. He's a Swedish man. He was formerly head of the Amnesty International. And he strongly suggested, well, actually, it is more than strongly suggested. I know for sure because I was there as the UN political ambassador and he was there as the UN human rights representative. And I know that he drafted the letter, you see. So asking the UN for help with this trial. And it's signed by both prime minister. And so the letter asked the Secretary General of the UN, they say, we have no money, you know. Please help us try this tribunal. Now, in the meantime, there was a big violent clash in Cambodia, and this Ranarit fellow was ousted by Hun Sen, so Hun Sen became the only prime minister. So the UN, of course, was very happy. Oh, we can have another tribunal, you know, a lot of jobs, you know, like the Rwanda tribunal in Arusha and the Hague tribunal for the ex-Yugoslavia. So there was an expert group, blah, 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 you know, and they suggested that it should be an international tribunal, you know, like Arusha. Well, they have five options, they said. International tribunal or try these Khmerus outside Cambodia. Anyway, but this Hun Sen says, no, this is our problem. It must be a Cambodian tribunal. And that's where the fight is, you know. Because in the letter, actually, they say, we have no money. Please help us with the trial. But the UN said, you want money? Yes, but we control it, you know. Hun Sen said, no, just give the money, you see. Of course, there was this fight. Another 10 years delayed. In the meantime, all these leaders became very old, you know. And Pol Pot has died. So as I said, control of the tribunal was the main issue over which the Cambodian government and the United Nations argued at every twist and turn. Because every time the Cambodians wanted more control. And the UN wanted, no, you know, you want our money and our assistance, it has to be international standards. So this lawyer starts bickering back and forth. So that's the problem, you know. One of the problems is that the lawyers want, the Western lawyers want the perfect international tribunal. The Cambodians wanted a Cambodian tribunal. But they forget the political aspects. You know, they're arguing about how many judges should be here, how many judges should be there, and it should be a what they call a supermajority, meaning even if there are four Cambodian judges and one international or two international, one international must vote with the Cambodians because they are afraid these Cambodians are all stooges of Hun Sen and they will all vote one thing. So in February, the UN walked out even because the UN legal office is very, as I said, legal-minded. But the donor countries are the politicians here. They say, no, no, you know, we must have this trial because that's the only way we bring justice to Cambodia, you know, with this trial. Actually, the West here got split. Well, when the West, I mean, include Japan, you know. Japan and Australia were the biggest supporters of this tribunal. What they say is, better a flawed tribunal than no tribunal at all. But the Europeans were lobbied by this Hans Corell, who is a European, and they are the legal people and say, no, we must have a real international tribunal or nothing. Well, then they established what they call the extraordinary chambers in the courts of Cambodia. It started functioning in 2006. Then came corruption charges because this tribunal cost a lot of money, not as much as Arusha or The Hague, which cost hundreds of millions of dollars, but still a lot because all the international judges, the international prosecutors, the security guards, you know, come from the UN in New York. They all got paid international salaries. And then the Cambodian employees, this is the crucial thing, also get paid very high salaries. And so the Cambodians, some of them are whispering, you know, that so-and-so took 25% of my salary. Now, I don't want to mention names here if I'm recorded, but actually these corruption charges continue to escalate. And the name actually came out because there was a German delegation who visited and somebody blurted out the name of this person who apparently took bribes. This is a normal practice, by the way, in Cambodia and in many Asian countries. You know, you have to give kickbacks from your salary. But of course, the UN says, we are administering this money. We cannot have this corruption. And the donors also says, I don't want, you know, my money to go down the drain in corruption. But then there is a complication. The complication comes, okay, and the complication come in number two. How many should be tried? I will deal with number two first, then I go back to number one. Nixon is dead, so he cannot sue me. But Kissinger is an advisor to Obama. So that's why I deal with number two first, because that ties in with this corruption business. Remember I said there were five defendants who are in jail now. This jail is interesting, you know, because it's supposed to be an international jail. It's not Cambodian jail, but the Cambodians say it's Cambodian. I saw this jail, you know. Anyway, they cannot escape, apparently, but maybe they can bribe the security, but the security get paid international wages, minus 25%, of course. So who should be tried? Number two first. How many should be tried? Now, suddenly this international prosecutor, Robert Petit, a Frenchman, said, no, five is not enough. I have evidence that other five people should be tried. Now, so it's very controversial, because if you try 5 + 5 + 5, we'll be there forever, and they will all be dead, you know. We will all be dead. And the Cambodians are very much looking for justice. Get it over with, for heaven's sake. Find them guilty, and then here we are not, we haven't, we are just trying number one, you know, Keng Kangkek Oich or Doij. Cambodia has how many vowels? 26? 26 vowels, yeah. So Deutsch is D-U-C-H, but it's pronounced Deutsch. And so the international says, five more. And the Cambodian prosecutor, a lady, says, no, you know, that will cause turmoil, because the Khmer Rouge are still, they are still there. You know, they have all surrendered to Hun Sen, but they are in units, they are still controlling some areas. Alvin has been to the house of this Nuon Chea, so certain provinces are still Khmer Rouge, ex-Khmer Rouge people are living there together. So she says, five is enough, you see. And Hun Sen, the prime minister, also says, you know, this is, five is enough. Because from the beginning, Hun Sen was not very keen on this tribunal. You know, he signed the letter, because when Hammerberg asked him, he said, oh yeah, I want to sign that letter because I want to destroy the Khmer Rouge. So what he says, Hun Sen, is that he wants to use the trial to defeat the Khmer Rouge, which, as you remember, was left intact because of us, UNTAC, cuddling the Khmer Rouge like with kid gloves, you know. And so Hun Sen says, you know, five is enough. And then, as I said, it's curious, because in the previous frame we saw that the tribunal is run out of money. So the Westerners, of course, are supporting this Mr. Robert Petit. So they say, we want five more, but they haven't even paid for this five to finish, you see. So now we are at this stage, you know, I was there last week, the money ran out. But every time the money ran out, Japan keeps coming, you know, with 10 million here and there. I don't know, they have too much money, I think, the Japanese, I don't know. But because they always rescue the tribunal. I don't know, maybe some of you know why. Of course, Japan wants the tribunal to succeed, but at this rate, we'll be there forever, you see. Now they want five more. And the Hun Sen, this prime minister, says, in private, you know, I heard him saying, let's get this Kangkek Deutsch, you know, trial finished, and then we have these four more to be, we'll close down this bloody tribunal with all these problems, and then I will, we will try the four in Cambodian court, and then they will be pardoned or something. Because actually, these four have already surrendered to Cambodian. And, you know, when Hun Sen signed this letter in June, Ieng Sary has already surrendered with a big chunk of Khmer Rouge. And actually, he was given an amnesty. But he was given an amnesty because during the Vietnamese occupation, they already had a trial of the Khmer Rouge. In January 1979, as I said, Cambodia was liberated, you know, and in that year, 79, they had a trial of the Khmer Rouge, of which Pol Pot and Ieng Sary were already condemned to death. So Ieng Sary was amnestied from that trial, but that trial was done, not recognized internationally, because it's done by the People's Republic with Vietnam only. So these people are actually already amnestied. The other two, Khieu Samphan, that is the president of Cambodia, and Ieng Thirit, that's the wife of Ieng Sary, they were surrendering already. The only one who didn't surrender was a man called Tham Mok. Tham Mok is the biggest butcher, you know, even bigger than Deutsch. He killed so many people and so on, but he was arrested, and then he died, you know. So this, according to Hun Sen, enough is enough, you know, let's get it over with, and let's tackle poverty rather than continue to keep on trying these people. So once more, you know, the West doesn't want to give money because of corruption. But they said, we must try 5 more. So I don't know where. Japan gives 10 million more, but not, that's not enough. You know, they need $50 million more because these people get paid a fortune. That's why they have to kick back their salaries, you know, to get these jobs. It's very lucrative. In Cambodia, it's a very poor country. You know, you're lucky if you get $50 a month. And these jobs are hundreds of dollars, which is a fortune there. Now, just one more about who should be tried. Nixon, why Nixon? Well, during 69 to 73, Nixon bombed, in his own words, the bejesus out of Cambodia. He says, you know, let's use everything we have to bomb every moving creature, because he was very mad, you know, because the Cambodians were using their eastern part for the Ho Chi Minh Trail. That is for Ho Chi Minh to bring troops and material to South Vietnam. So he bombed the bejesus out of East Cambodia. And that's why they were very angry, the people there. And they all joined the Khmer Rouge. Can you imagine, you know, it's like September 11 every day for 5 years. So very, very angry people, the one who didn't die, joined the Khmer Rouge. The second thing is that this Sihanouk fellow in March 1970 was ousted by the right-wing general Lon Nol. This is 1970, because they used the Indonesian example, 65, you know, Indonesia was, we had this G30 as 30 September move, and Sukarno was replaced by Suharto. And in Indonesia's case, about 800,000 people got killed, but Suharto became very powerful. But in the case of Cambodia, you know, Sihanouk was removed by Lon Nol, so Lon Nol is like the Suharto of Cambodia. But he was a very weak man, and Sihanouk, what he did was he went to China and embraced the Khmer Rouge, because the Khmer Rouge main sponsor is China, you see. So he embraced the Khmer Rouge in China. And so therefore, that's why the Khmer Rouge became so strong. You know, Hun Sen told me, I joined the Khmer Rouge because I saw Sihanouk. In those days, there's no internet or TV, but somehow he knows that Sihanouk embraced the Khmer Rouge, so I should join Sihanouk, you know, and therefore join the Khmer Rouge. And that's why the Khmer Rouge became so powerful. So that's why I say, should Nixon or Kissinger be tried, you know, or Sihanouk. Many people in Cambodia believe Sihanouk should be on trial, because he was, you know, when 17 April, I mentioned, they entered Phnom Penh, Sihanouk was the president of that Khmer Rouge. But soon he was put under house arrest. And then again, as I said, he was very happy with the Khmer Rouge, because he was very angry at America for ousting him. You know, so Sukarno in Indonesia kept quiet, you see. And therefore, Suharto became very powerful. But Sihanouk did not keep quiet. He just fled to Beijing and embraced the Khmer Rouge. Now, going now to the last frame, because I like a lot of discussion. Will this trial finally bring justice to Cambodia? As I said, the Cambodian population is a pyramid like this. Even if you compare the pyramid of Thailand, it's like this, fat in the middle. But Cambodia is like this. That means it's a very, very young population. Many of them were born, of course, after the Khmer Rouge. Now, education on the Khmer Rouge era is non-existent, because, you know, the kings, as I said, king is sympathetic towards the Khmer Rouge, so he didn't want people to educate the Khmer Rouge. In fact, the museum, the Tuol Sleng prison called S21, which was headed by our friend Deutsch, that becomes a museum now. you see. So education is non-existent. And certainly, Cambodia's economic growth has been spectacular. So all the young people want now is jobs and learn English. If you want to volunteer, you teach English in Cambodia, there are plenty of jobs there. So maybe I should stop here and ask discussions.
Thank you very much. It's very provocative. I'm sure there are a lot of questions. So,
I've a question.
Yes.
Josh, and then
my name is Josh Martin, and in the mid-90s, CNOOC offered, or actually granted, royal pardons to several of the people that are on trial right now. How was that circumvented by the logistics of the court now?
Okay, 1996, Ieng Sary, you know, this man who was number three of, you know, brother number three. Brother number one is Pol Pot. Brother number two is Nuon Chai. He and a big chunk of Khmer Rouge, which are housed in the west of Cambodia, called Pai Len. This is part of a province of Battambang, closest to Thailand, you see. I mean, the Khmer Rouge, when they were defeated, they are very close to Thailand. That says something about Thailand, but that's not our topic. That's not your question. So this Khmer Rouge surrendered, you see, with Ieng Sary. But then Hun Sen, who was very happy, of course, because there were two prime ministers, don't forget. One is Rana Rit and one is Hun Sen, which is the most bizarre thing. You know, I mentioned that in my book. It's a very complicated thing. But Hun Sen says, asked the king, you know, you have to pardon him because he brought in all these Khmer Rouge troops, you see, and that is a great, conquest for the government, a great achievement. So the king says, no, I don't want to sign any. Anyway, at the end, he says, you guys sign, you know, the two guys, you know. So anyway, to make a long story short, finally he was pardoned. But he was pardoned only, there is the twist, you know, as you rightly said, he was pardoned only from the death sentence imposed by the court, which was held during the People's Republic of Cambodia. So,
oh, that was the
yes, the one that, that was the trial that was actually a trial, you know, not recognized by the international community because it was organized by the Vietnamese. So they told him, you know, this Ieng Sary, well, you're pardoned. So he is happy. He brought to, I was there, you know, when he was. Actually, I came with Hun Sen in a helicopter that can host 300 people. This is Russian made. It's the biggest helicopter in the world. There's a picture of it in my book, you know. But Hun Sen was accepting the surrender of Ieng Sary. It was very bizarre, this helicopter. For me, especially as Indonesian, you know, because Hun Sen was protected by 300 in this helicopter. Cambodian troops who were trained in Indonesia, you know, they were wearing Kopassus uniforms. Kopassus is the special forces of Indonesia. What?
The notorious one.
Yeah. But the presidential candidate for Prabowo, you know, but he lost. So anyway, we were in this helicopter. I was the UN ambassador, you know. I was asked to witness the surrender of Ieng Sary. And then we landed at the, this is the biggest helicopter in the world. And 300 of these Kopassus, you know, Indonesian troops. And Ieng Sary was accompanied by thousands of Khmer Rouge dressed in Chinese uniform, you know, Chinese army. So it's like Indonesia and China. You know, I have a picture of that in my book, but in my book there is a picture. Hun Sen was greeting Ieng Sary, and Hun Sen was so protected by Kopassus, and Ieng Sary was protected by the People's Liberation Army. And, you know, until today, I was there in Cambodia. We have our new ambassador, Ngurah Swachaya. He's from Indonesia, from my friend from New York. And the first thing Hun Sen did was receive this ambassador in his compound because Hun Sen protects himself from everybody by having this Indonesian trained, you know, troops, you know, two battalions of that. So my ambassador says when he arrived, they say, "Siap!" That is an Indonesian, you know. So they are like Indonesian troops there. But going back to your Ing Sari, so he was, of course, at that time, he didn't know that he was tricked. He was given pardon. He said, "I will surrender only if the king pardons me." So he was pardoned. But later, you see these lawyers, you can never trust them. I hope there are no lawyers. Later, you know, they had this twist, you know, they said, "Oh, you were pardoned from that trial by the Vietnamese." Yeah, but not future trials. Yeah. So when he was arrested the second time, Hun Sen told him, "Now you go to jail," you know. But in the meantime, he lived in a beautiful mansion in Phnom Penh because he was pardoned. Yes.
I'm also really interested in sustainable development in Cambodia, and really enjoyed your book. I read it when it first came out. And
you read it?
Yes, I commend you on it. I think it's very important for you to be talking about these issues so honestly. And I was wondering, last summer I spent the entire summer volunteering with NGOs in Cambodia, a variety of them. And I got a sense from the aid workers, as well as the people who were working with in villages and in Phnom Penh, that they feel that there's not a lot of hope for the future, that Cambodia will slip back into war, and that the steps, for every step that's taken forward economically and politically, there are two steps taken backwards, kind of in the shadows, people can't see. And I was wondering, as somebody who works with, you know, and the very opposite of where I was working, so at the very highest levels and echelons of all the powers that are in the region, what your take or projection for the next couple of years is?
I'm very glad to answer this question because this book, you know, conveniently ends in 1997, you know. But, of course, I continue to be interested in Cambodia. This past year, I've been twice in Cambodia and last year also. And the Economist Intelligence Unit, I'm sure everyone knows that, says that Cambodia is the country number three, the threat, you know, after, even before Afghanistan and so on, after Zimbabwe and Chad, you know. And so, of course, the Economist Intelligence Unit is anonymous, so we don't know who is writing it, but, you know. So Hun Sen, of course, was ranting and raving. We had the Asian Economic Forum, and he had a written speech, you know, written by some economists, very good about the mortgage-backed securities and so on. And then when he came to this Economist Intelligence Unit, he started shouting and screaming, "Economic stupid unit," he says. And, you know, this Hun Sen, you have to know, you know, him, you know. But to make a long story short, Hun Sen is a very wily fellow, you know. I'm still recorded. Eh? Anyway, I want to go back to Cambodia. But anyway, he knows, you know, how to maneuver, you know, on a tightrope, the West, and then he wants to keep a tight rein, you know. So he has the trappings of democracy, elections, and so on. But I, as an economist, I think the Economist Intelligence Unit is exaggerating, you know. Because as an economist, as I said, the country has progressed a lot. If you compare to Myanmar, for instance, you know, actually Myanmar, Hun Sen was telling this Myanmar Tan Sui, you know, "You are stupid, you know, you should play ball with these Westerners, you know, just give democracy, human rights, blah, 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 and then they give you foreign aid." Because this Hun Sen fellow gets the most foreign aid now, this year, which means I'm not here making propaganda for Hun Sen. All the donors give him more aid than ever. He gets $1 billion now, which is, for Cambodia, a big sum. In New York, where we live, in Stamford, you know, well, you know, in the U.S., $1 billion is nothing now. You know, $1 trillion bailout here, AIG, $700 billion. But for Cambodia, $1 billion is a lot of money, of which $200 million came from China. So my answer has to be a little bit long because... Yeah, because economically they are growing very fast. However, there are signs of danger, you know. Because their economy base is based on tourism, textiles, and agriculture. Now, tourism had grown by leaps and bounds. Now there are 2 million tourists for Cambodia. Well, 15 million in Thailand, but Cambodia is a small country. And I used to be the governor of Siem Reap, remember? Well, nobody knew except me, but anyway, that time my wife and I lived in a little shack, you know, paying $500, and electricity was not running because Hun Sen was bankrupt, you know, because he was isolated by the West. Anyway, now that little shack of where I live for $500 is surrounded by huge, huge giant hotels, you know. But it's still there, that little house. It's like an antique, and I took a picture, and it was published in the Phnom Penh Post, you know, my picture in front of my house. But I don't think there is a danger of revolution. The reason I say this is I mentioned Hun Sen's security guard, you know. They are, as Tagore says, well, we don't like the Kopassus, but they are well-trained, you know. Yeah. They are very good in training. What? Yes, you see. And Hun Sen is always 3 steps ahead of everybody. He is like a chess player that is 3 steps ahead, you see. So he built his house he carved it out of a jungle from near Phnom Penh. So he has the whole road carved out and to the house, and he has these 2 battalions, you know, trained by Indonesia, very good, you know, and tanks and everything. 100% loyal to him because he pays them $300. Usually soldiers in Cambodia get $30, you know. So he is not in danger of being overthrown militarily, because there is a big army there, but you know, the army there all they do is collect bribes here and there. You know, they don't even, I never see them march, you know, except for Hun Sen's troops. So this, if you go to his house, you know, this whole road is, there are, you know, sharpshooters and snipers there, and there are houses. So in terms of the danger of collapse, and that's why I think the Economist Intelligence Unit is wrong. I may be wrong, you see. And secondly, you know, you remember I said there were 2 governments, Rana Rit and Hun Sen. Now, Rana Rit won the election, actually, because the king's party won the election, which is amazing. You know, Hun Sen was very angry. He says, you, Untak, you know, traitors, you know, you make Rana Rit win, you see, because you are pro-American and you are against me. Well, of course, I think, you know, I was there with the people. They voted for Rana Rit because they voted for the king. You know, the king in a country like Cambodia, you're in archaeology. You know, they are like a Dewa Raja. And actually, they're talking about king, you know, Dewa Raja, that concept came from Java, you know, from India to Java. And really? Yeah, yes. Well, I have a chapter, what is it, 3 maybe. The king was thanking Akashi, that's my Japanese boss, who was the president of Cambodia, like I was the governor of Siem Reap. He says, thank you, Akashi-san, for bringing the second prince of Java here. And that is me, you know. Because the first prince of Java is Jaya Warman II. You heard, huh? You heard that he came from Java. Yeah, and so I came, and I come from Borobudur, Magelang, from Borobudur to Angkor Wat, you know. But that's neither here nor there. Where was I? I forgot now. Yeah. So going back to this 4 armies, Rana Rit won the elections, but his army is minuscule, because when Hun Sen was defeated, when Hun Sen was made prime minister by the Vietnamese, as I said, America and China want to recognize the Khmer Rouge, and they assisted the Khmer Rouge and the Phun Sin Pek to defeat Hun Sen. 3 groups are on the perch on the border of Cambodia, with the help of their great friend and neighbor, Thailand, you see. If you have Thailand as a friend, I don't know. But anyway, So they were there perched on the border, but very small army. So when he won the election, Ranarit, he has nothing. A very small army integrated into Hun Sen's army, which is huge, of course. And so that time not yet trained by Kopassus, you know, trained by the Vietnamese. But very good army, because the Vietnamese are very good soldiers, you know. And so that is Ranarit's army was very small. Now, during this second part of my book, meaning during the new part of two prime ministers, Ranarit wanted to have equal balance with Hun Sen. He says, Hun Sen has so many troops, you know, like two children, you know, he has more toys than me. So Ranarit in 1996 had a congress, you know, and first they invited Hun Sen to the congress. And after Hun Sen left, you know, Ranarit says, I don't want to be a puppet prime minister. And I don't want my people to be puppet governors and so on. I want equal balance with Hun Sen. So where does he turn? There's no other way to turn. He has no soldiers. To his former allies, Khmer Rouge. And that's why Hun Sen got scared to death, because the only good soldiers are the Khmer Rouge and the trained by Kopassus, you know, from Indonesia. So here was the second part of my stay there was a competition between Hun Sen and Ranarit to fight for the Khmer Rouge soldiers. So going back to your original question, economy is growing very fast except this year. The textiles and the tourism, there are less tourists, but there are no American tourists anyway, but the Korean tourists were number one, and then Chinese number two. Now the Koreans are bankrupt also, you know. Well, Iceland is bankrupt, but Korea is almost bankrupt. So they also stopped coming. They were supposed to build the first skyscraper in Cambodia, the 42 tower. And now they took a deposit from everybody, you know, and then they disappeared. Anyway, so there is economic downturn. But number one, as I said, militarily, there will probably be no civil war because this Ranarit has nothing. Now, of course, now Hun Sen is like the king now, you see. He has now 6 or 7 titles, you know. Moha Senopati, just like our Senopati, Techo Hun Sen, you know. So maybe he also comes from Java, you know. Senopati, yeah, I looked at him. So he's like a king. So now, of course, he has to worry about the danger inside the party. But nobody has arms, you know. His chief of staff, Kau Kim Yan, you know, is a very good man and trained not by Vietnam but by Russia, you see. But Hun Sen just kicked him out. Have you heard that? You have heard. So, and he was replacing him by Paul Sarun, who is a Hun Sen man. So you have to, Hun Sen is now so powerful, he doesn't trust even his own people, except a few, you see. But he, as I said, is a good chess player. He is always 3 steps ahead. So he does this sort. So militarily, there's no danger, I think. That's my question. Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
So, you know, I think the typical way in which people interpret the UN coming into Cambodia and also helping with these trials and so on is that they're able to accomplish things you know, that wouldn't have been able to be done otherwise by domestic actors. In other words, sort of local groups that are powerless to appeal to the national governments are able to appeal to the international governments, who then appeal to the national governments. And so it's kind of a happy story. But in some ways, you kind of presented a kind of critical analysis of the UN kind of pushing its own imperatives onto the national government, and also the national government having their own kinds of interests by accepting them. So do you see those kind of as problematic, that it's not all a happy story, but you know, the national governments in some ways are also using these trials and so on for their own sort of...
Yes. Just a quick one first. You mentioned there were 2 interventions. The UNTAC, which cost $1.7 billion, of which I was part. That was... even though I said it's a flawed, but it did bring some peace because of these 2 governments, you know, the government of Khmer Rouge, which was recognized by the West and the rest, and the government of People's Republic of Cambodia, recognized by Vietnam and Russia. So we serve a purpose, because through the election we brought them together. Now about the trial. Yeah, the trial is a very strange phenomenon, because as I said, it was signed by a letter which was actually drafted by the Swede Thomas Hammerberg. So Ragnar Ryd actually reluctantly signed it, because he says the Khmer Rouge we are on the verge of trying to bring the Khmer Rouge back into our fold, and now this trial could be in trouble, you know. Now Hun Sen says, I want to sign this letter because he wants to try, at that time, he wants to try the Khmer Rouge, because he wants to use the trial to defeat the last parts of the Khmer Rouge. But you are right, you know, gradually I realized that they are not really that interested. At least Hun Sen is, well, Ragnar Ryd is finished now, so he doesn't play anymore. But Hun Sen is thinking that it could cause trouble, you know. First of all, this thing, insistence about international standards. You know, the judges in the Cambodian standards are, you know, underpaid, corrupt, and influenced by the government. So he wants to control that trial. But if possible, I think if you ask me, you know, he doesn't want that trial, you know. So you are right there, you see. Now, in 79, they tried the Khmer Rouge, you know, when the Vietnamese first came there, they tried already the Khmer Rouge. Because the question now becomes, how do we achieve justice, you see? How do we achieve justice? Is it through this trial of these old people and all this corruption and this, should we try five and so on? Now, I personally think that the Cambodians should achieve justice by other means. Well, we have the Truth Commission in South Africa. Actually, Hun Sen favored that, you know. Or we have the conversations in Rwanda, which is very good, you know. The guilty ones who were in jail for a long time, they started talking to the families that they have harmed. But I agree with you that even that is no longer probably feasible or wanted in Cambodia. Because what happened is, there was, because of these manipulations and so on, this anti-Khmer Rouge feeling has developed into either the young people don't even know what is the Khmer Rouge, you see. And so I personally think that there was not enough emphasis on other means for reconciliation. For instance, all this grief, everyone has suffered from the Khmer Rouge, but there is no religious, you know, way, for instance, to, well, if I see in the U.S., for instance, when there is a, like 9/11, everyone goes to church, you see. But there is no religious ceremonies or what to get rid of this. So I do think that, yes, the U.N. imposing this, you see, is really not 100% doing a favor. Because one should see that the UN consists of many different components. This Thomas Hammerberg is human rights, you know, he is a lawyer, all right. But human rights is a small unit in Geneva. Well, not so small, you know, but it is not dealing with trials. Trials are dealt with by the Security Council, and it costs hundreds of millions of dollars. So when the Hammerberg present this letter, here is a letter from Hun Sen and Ragnar Ryd. The Security Council refused to discuss this because China says no way. You know, China is the sponsor of Khmer Rouge. So China says no trial, you know. They don't want to discuss. So this is the problem with the UN. There's so many components. Like now, for instance, the International Criminal Court has already condemned the president of Sudan. But the Security Council is divided because there are, you know, the Cold War is over. I mentioned over and over again, during the Cold War, there's always pro-Soviet and pro, but now we still have that. Sudan, you know, if you take this to the Security Council, maybe the Chinese and the Russians don't want to sign. China has oil, you see, in Sudan. And so there is still, so basically, to talk to the UN today, the Cold War is over, but powers like China and even Europe sometimes say, hey, US, you are not alone, you know, we are here. You see, this is not the Cold War. But so I don't know whether that answers your question, you know. So the UN is also, but I agree with you, with this $60 million, it should have been given for other things. Or now it's $100 million they want, you know, for this tribunal. But of course, if you ask the West, they don't want to give $60 million for other things. They want to have the trial. But yeah, if it was not done, maybe there would have been no trial at all, or at best some kind of, you know, truth commission or something like that.
UN role in Cambodia or the UN role in East Timor.
Yes.
And his argument was that some lessons had been learned in Cambodia, even though mistakes were still made in East Timor, not as many mistakes were made because of the Cambodian experience. Would you agree with that? Do you think that the UN learned something
about Cambodia? Not in the way of for the trial. For the peacekeeping in Timor, we did learn something, you know. Although we the now I'm talking about the UN, you know, we still make the same mistake, you know. For instance, security. You see, as I said, when we entered the UNTAC, entered Cambodia, they say, oh, we are all happy family now, you know. Khmer Rouge is not the enemy, he is a good boy. So what did we do? We spent $1.7 billion without thinking about security. Because we have 15,000 troops, but they are not there for security. They are there to demobilize the army. Because they say, oh, these are all good boys, you know, we just take their guns and then they are demobilized. So when it came to East Timor, the same thing happened with the plebiscite, you see. There was no troops for security. I remember Fendrell, my colleague, you know, says, well, everything will be hunky-dory. So Indonesia was supposed to be in charge of security. But every time the security got worse, you know, Kofi Annan called Habibie, and then Wiranto says, okay, we send two more battalions. And so on security, of course, if we want to say learn from Cambodia, we have to provide security on East Timor, which costs a fortune, you see. Now, the other thing on the trial, East Timor is again a little different because Cambodia is Cambodians killing Cambodians, you see. Now, East Timor, of course, the Truth Commission also, because East Timorese were tried. But there are guilty people in Indonesia, which became a different country, so they cannot try these people. Probably the lesson to be learned is that every nation is different. Now, Darfur, you see, as I said, the president is already indicted now. And he has ostensibly agreed for UN troops to be there, but you cannot send UN troops without the consent of him. And now he has kicked out all the aid workers also in Darfur. It's a very complex thing, this whole, because the problem is, who is the boss in the UN? There's nobody is the boss. As I said, America exerts an undue influence, but even that now is diminishing because America is still the world power, you know. But economically, China owns America's debt, you know. 1 billion treasury bonds, 1 trillion treasury bonds is owned by China.
And could I just follow up on that? Sorry.
Yeah.
New Zealand was, when I was living in New Zealand, there was a very small point when they were chair of the Security Council. That was sort of a big thing for country of 4 million people. So
yeah.
What they did was have lots of seminars, public seminars around the country about what we're doing and, you know, the kind of things we're doing. And of course, Cambodia was then. And I remember being at one of these seminars, and there was a representative from New Zealand Armed Forces who were actually engineers, and their job was to do the debombing and
demining,
train,
yeah.
Demining and,
yes.
And train Khmer to do that. But one of the captains said to me, he said, in my view, he said, looking at me, there are only 5 countries in the world that should be allowed to be in peacekeeping forces, and he said, meaningfully, Australia is not one of them. But so I've heard very bad reports of the behaviour of peacekeeping forces from the United Nations in, well, specifically Cambodia. In your experience, do the peacekeeping, UN peacekeeping forces keep the faith, as it were, or?
Well, the worst, if I may say, is still on the recording or not, is the Bulgarian troops. Because Bulgaria has sent, communism was replaced by this new government, and they sent gangsters, you know, to Cambodia, and they were raping, and they went to brothels, and they want to sleep with the wife of the brothel, and so on. And so even the Khmer Rouge was very angry. They were invited for dinner, because remember, they are not the enemy. And they killed some Bulgarians. So in terms of bad behavior, yes, there are, but it depends on, some countries are behaving better than others. Pakistani troops were also running brothels, I was told, you see. The Dutch were the best because they were not allowed to drink, you know. Can you imagine? We learned drinking from our colonial masters, the Dutch, but they were... So they were in my province, you know, Siem Reap, and they always ask me, the troops, that's true, can I be stationed there at Odar Minchai? I said, yes. So every time the Dutch ask me, you know, can I go to Odar Minchai? Of course, Odar Minchai is at the border of Thailand, so they go to the other side and drink there. But the worst, actually, is in Africa. You know, there are stories of UN troops in Congo who raped, and a lot of them. So the UN troops are just as good as they are human beings, you see. Akashi, my head, you know, he made the NGOs in Cambodia very angry because there was a protest that these soldiers go to these massage parlors, you know. So he says, oh, what do you expect from young people, you know? Just park your UN car outside, far away from the massage parlor. Oh, all the NGOs were very angry about that. Now, about the 5 countries, yes, smaller countries, but Australia should be included. Canada is also good, you know, for that. Are better than big countries, you know, for peacekeeping. But actually, we don't have enough peacekeeping, so we take anybody. Now, in Africa, it's mostly African troops going there. And, you know, well, I just mentioned that it happens to be in Africa where the big UN troops are, you know, are raping and so on. But so, because you see, these troops are not specifically international peacekeepers. They are just soldiers and brought over there. And now I mentioned I have 3 pair of lenses. At least I know in New York, you know, what this UNTAC is all about. Many of them don't know, you see. They don't know. They just sit there. And they have to do this, they have to do that. But I must say, yeah, we were having good experience of the D-miners. But these Dutch, they always want to go to the Thai border to drink. Okay. Yeah.
Just to kind of follow up on that.
Oh. Yeah.
Just to ask, you know, you were with the UN, but to what extent do you think it would be sort of appropriate or sort of in the future to have more like an ASEAN type of involvement? Or is that just unrealistic?
Well, you see, as I said, there is not enough troops, actually. But ASEAN, the problem there is also split, you see. For instance, on this Myanmar, which is a member of ASEAN. Now, our ambassador, Indonesia, in Cambodia, is one of our top men, you know. I asked him, you know, why do they waste a top man like you for Cambodia? But he is there for ASEAN. So, yes, regional organizations should and do play a big role in Africa, especially. There is the African Union, and there is the Gulf, cooperating countries. So regional countries should play a big role, but it should all be still under the umbrella of the UN. You know, we cannot have ASEAN troops. And in Africa, they do. You see, in Darfur, they had African troops going there before the UN was allowed by this president, you know. So they had African troops there. So they were killing each other also, you see. This is, I'm not saying anything, but this is happening there. So, in terms of morals, it's the same, you see. I mean, these are, as Akashi rightly said, maybe, these are young people. What do you expect, you know? Yes, Paul?
One more question. I think
we read very little about the economics and financial affairs of the Khmer Rouge after they've been deposed of military power and moved to the borders. But at that time, the gem and timber trade was really bringing in hundreds of millions of dollars. What happened to that money in the Thai banks?
Okay.
Do you have any?
Yes. Actually, I know something about it. No, I didn't participate in this gem trade, but chapter 5, if you remember, chapter 5, I was asked by Sihanouk to accompany him in a helicopter to visit the Khmer Rouge area, because don't forget, as I said, Sihanouk is a friend of the Khmer Rouge, you see. So I was asked to accompany him in a UN helicopter by Akashi, because they want the senior man to, I'm like a wine taster, you know, because if I die, then he dies also. So anyway, coming to your country, we arrived in Pai Lin, that's the capital of the Khmer Rouge area. And Akashi, about 6 months before that, he was refused entry with the bamboo pole. We call it the bamboo pole incident, because a young man, Khmer Rouge, refused him entry. Actually, what they want to keep a secret from him is, I was watching it, because I was with Sihanouk, and I was watching an around-the-clock trade of trucks going into Thailand. So the Thais, as I said, if you have Thais as friends, you know, you don't need Khmer Rouge as your enemies. So the Thais were a thriving trade, you know, and gems, and yeah, around the clock, because they were afraid if the UN comes in, you know, then it's the end of it. The Thais were trading with the Khmer Rouge. Well, so that is the... They are the rich Khmer Rouge there. Then there's the poor Khmer Rouge in An Long Veng. Where did you go? No, Pai Lin. So there are the rich Khmer Rouge and there's the poor Khmer Rouge. The Pai Lin people are the rich Khmer Rouge. I was sitting there and I had more electricity. I mentioned, you know, my wife and I were in Siem Reap and we had no electricity, maybe 1 hour a night, you know. In the Khmer Rouge area, it's 24 hours. So they were quite wealthy, but they were sticking together. Still, so it is okay. And then I came with this 300 Kopassus soldiers, but with Hun Sen and me came Mr. Teng Bun Ma, talking about economics. Teng Bun Ma is the richest man in Cambodia, you know, at that time. And he was watching, you know, this Indonesian troops and the Chinese troops. Well, you know, in the uniforms, we were escorted by them, and he was looking left and right. This Teng Bun Ma. Now he got the concession there to build casinos. So the Khmer Rouge area is very rich now, because in Thailand there are no casinos. So they all come to casino and karaoke in Cambodia, you see. So it's now the story is all economics. Even I surrendered, you know. They left, surrendered. I'm an advisor to a private equity fund of American funds, you know. I don't get paid much, you know. That's why I have to go to New York first. To come here.
Well, this has been a very provocative and
thank you.
Entertaining, also,
thank you.
But also sobering overview of events. And we do thank you for sharing your experiences with us. We've had a wonderful 1.5 hours. So
thank you. Thank you.
This podcast is a production of the Center for Southeast Asian Studies at the University of Hawaii. The center's director is Professor Barbara Watson-Andaya. The associate director is Paul Rausch. The Brown Bag series is coordinated by Hua Lei, and the podcast series is produced by Christian Razukas. Your announcer is Nozia Azmi. This is a free service made possible by the center the University of Hawaii, and the United States Department of Education. For more podcasts, videos, and information about Southeast Asia, visit our website at hawaii.edu/CSEAS.